ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, welcome to PM. I'm Samantha Donovan, coming to you from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation in Melbourne. Tonight, Australians mark Anzac Day, both here and around the world. A chance for people to show their respect, and for those who've served, a day to stop and reflect.
It's a chance for us to regroup and see all our past mates that we've served with, where we're collectively all in the same place, in the same headspace, and we have that opportunity to be able to talk amongst ourselves.
Also, a huge effort to save beached pilot whales in Western Australia. And in the United States, pro-Palestinian protests grow on university campuses. Thousands of people have gathered at Anzac services around Australia and the world, including at the place where the legend began, Gallipoli. From Papua New Guinea to France and London, veterans and their families have been marking the catastrophic landings on that Turkish beach in 1915 and remembering all those who've served in the armed forces of Australia and New Zealand ever since. Nell Whitehead prepared this report.
In the darkness, hundreds gathered on the shore at Gallipoli to pay their respects to the Anzacs. Music breaking the silence as the sun rose. It was on this peninsula at dawn on April 25th, 1915, that 16,000 Australian and New Zealand troops landed. Their campaign would prove disastrous, but their legacy endures.
109 years ago, on this day, at this time, at this place, the spirit of Anzac was born. It was found in a steely determination to honour the name of Australia.
Deputy Prime Minister Richard Marles attended the Gallipoli service.
This spirit has shone brightly in the men and women who have worn our nation's uniform throughout our history, in conflicts great and small, in which 103,000 have made the ultimate sacrifice.
Official representatives laid wreaths, flags raised to half-mast. In France, they gathered in the village of Villers-Bretonneux, commemorating the service and sacrifice of soldiers on the Western Front.
Here, in this very special place, in the Somme region of France, over 100 years ago, Australian troops recaptured the town of Villers-Bretonneux that had just hours before fallen into German hands.
Services were held from New Zealand to London and Thailand. The Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese starting the day in Papua New Guinea, where he and PNG Prime Minister James Marape laid wreaths after a two-day trek of the Kokoda Track.
Today we thank all serving members of the Australian Defence Force. Now, as darkness begins to lose its grip on the land, we think of those nights that must have seemed without end, here and across continents, across wars, across generations. And we give thanks that because of them, we can await what they made possible, the gift of a brighter dawn.
The Federal Opposition Leader Peter Dutton spoke at a dawn service in Brisbane.
We remember them so that we don't forget who we are, the people who choose courage over cowardice, camaraderie over tribalism, endeavour over indolence, gratitude over resentment, and national pride over national aversion.
Across Australia, after dawn ceremonies, marches were held, and crowds came to cheer on the men and women who've served their country. At this march in Adelaide, a proud family watched on.
We're here to support the people that save our country, and then we have a servant of meeting people that save our country.
That's right. And who's in the army in our family?
Your Uncle Jack.
And? Grandma and Granddad?
Dad.
Were they medics in the army?
Yes.
Yeah, so that's who we're here to support today, aren't we? Just everybody that helped defend our country. So we've got somewhere safe to live, don't we?
Among the crowds in Melbourne were veterans commemorating the Vietnamese and Indian soldiers who fought alongside ANZACs.
I'm Captain Rex Furtado. We are here to commemorate the participation of in the ANZAC Day, especially the Indian soldiers, the 16,000 of Indian soldiers who participated in the ANZAC, and 1,600 of them got killed in the action.
Other Australians came to remember family and friends who served.
My name's Colleen Anderson, and I'm just here today to remember my dad, who was a Second World War prisoner of war for many years, and his brother vanished on the Dakota Trail and has never been found, so I sort of come each year for both of them with my son Michael. Makes me sad though.
My wife's marching today for her father and my son. Yeah, it's a wonderful day and we've got to keep the tradition going. Got to keep going on, get the young ones to follow up and make sure they don't forget what everyone done for us to keep us in the lovely country we've got today, yeah?
It means a lot. My husband served in Vietnam. He's not marching today. He's in a wheelchair. Due to illness. And he's with my son and my granddaughter. So it's actually a very special day.
Well, my father is a Vietnam veteran in the Air Force, so I've actually had my brother fly over from America to march with him today for the first time at 86. And my son's there and we've got four generations here, so we're very proud. Australians are very proud for ANZAC Day and just what that represents to everyone, you know, united and supporting each other.
Some of the people watching the ANZAC Day march in Melbourne today. Nell Whitehead reporting. In Sydney's Rocks District on the harbour, servicemen and women and veterans are taking the time to reconnect and reflect on what this day means to them. This report from Alison Shaw.
In 3, 2, 1.
Venues packed to the brim in the historic Rocks District of Sydney.
We have a result, and it is tails.
Crowds spill out onto the streets, cheering on each round of two-up. Dennis Lyons is on his way to meet up with some friends he served with in Vietnam.
You catch up and have a few beers with my mate up here and then play a bit of two-up and see how we go. I come over from Western Australia to march with one of my mates for the last time. So it was important to come over and catch up with him and see some of the other guys. And, yeah, also for the respect for the past soldiers and those guys from previous wars who didn't make it home.
The streets are bustling, but some are lucky enough to find a more comfortable spot together, like this group at the Mercantile Hotel.
We wanted to get a seat. As you may have noticed, walking up, by the time the march is over, all the seats are taken.
Russell Lane spent 23 years in the Navy and says today is a reminder of the spirit of togetherness.
Now I'm out for 2 years. I still miss that connection with my country. So many people, both military members and civilians, have lost their lives in wars. We remember all of them, not just the soldiers who lost their lives, but everybody who's been affected by war and is being affected by war today in other countries.
Russell Lane is with his friends Kai Nguyen and Phil Kelly, who've both served in the Royal Australian Air Force.
In the ADF, it's always about being high tempo and you don't really get a chance to sit back and reflect. And ANZAC Day is one of those times where you get that opportunity where we're collectively all in the same place, in the same headspace, and we have that opportunity to be able to talk amongst ourselves and discuss the past there. Because really, for us, we're a very unique group in that it takes one to know one.
Personally, I remember my grandfather and his brothers from the First World War. My father and uncles in the Second World War, and my cousins and my friends in modern times.
Down the road, Frances Watkins is remembering her family who've served for generations.
The image I have in my mind is my family, the 18, 19, 20-year-olds that fought in Gallipoli and didn't come home.
For her, Anzac Day afternoon is about taking a chance to relax with her colleagues in the Defence Force.
Just purging all that, getting, you know, you've got it off your chest and now just relax and go on, like pick up and tomorrow and we go on again.
Also at the Rocks is Caitlin Fabby.
This is my first Anzac Day in uniform, so every Anzac Day prior, you know, I've been to a dawn service with family and been able to pay my respects that way, but doing it in uniform today is a whole different level of respect, and representing the Navy is given in a whole new level of meaning for me, so it's been a really beautiful day.
When people gather to mark this important day in Australian history, it's also a chance to strike up new friendships. Jack Enner met Vietnam War veteran John Shepherd today.
It's honestly been an absolute pleasure of mine to spend time with him and reflect on his experience along with the people he served with. It's really why I come out this day and spend time with people, as much as spending time with people I served with, spend time with people like himself.
My initiation in the service was as a national serviceman, called up for 2 years in conscription for the Vietnam War. After people voted for us to get involved against communism, they chose to spit upon us when we came home. That was really the psychological effect of the involvement in that conflict. Even today, the avoidance of the mention of Vietnam. A lot of people like to forget about it, but the soldiers who fought there will never forget.
It means a lot to me to really understand his sacrifice, his suffering.
What's the most special thing to you about this day?
In my mind, it's about the fact that we all get to live our freedom, right? Like the fact that we all get to see you get to report me right now. Like, that doesn't exist in all countries. Some people just want to go to the beach, some want to go to the park. I think that's what our Anzacs fought and died for. It makes me emotional that they did that.
For John Shepherd, this day will always be a meaningful one.
War's changed considerably. People have changed considerably. But we still hold on to the spirit of Anzac.
That's Vietnam veteran John Shepherd. Alison Chow with that report. This is PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. You can hear all our programs live or later on the ABC Listen app. Ahead, American aid finally on the way to Ukraine. A major effort has been underway in Western Australia's south today to save more than 100 pilot whales stranded at Toby Inlet near Dunsborough. Our reporter Jackie Lynch is there. Jackie, what's happening there at the moment?
Yes, well, it's quietened down a little bit just in the last couple of hours. There's about 30 whales on the beach. Unfortunately, those whales are dead, and researchers are going through and tagging them and taking some information from them. But the good news is there are about 160 whales on the beach at one stage, and most of those whales have made it out to sea, and we understand they're quite far out at the moment. So we do have about 30, sadly, still here on the beach, and those are dead, but a really, really good effort by volunteers and by everyone that was down here to rescue those whales that so far are staying out to sea.
Yes, so the whales that have gone out back to sea, were they assisted out by the volunteers or did they decide to go back themselves?
This was a big rescue mission this morning. Volunteers were down here. The Department of Biodiversity, Conservation and Attractions had people down here as well, members of the public. Some people have local knowledge of these kind of situations because it's not the first time we've seen this happen around the southwest. So everyone was kind of here helping, keeping the whales wet and helping to herald the whales out to sea, where there was boats and kind of keeping them further out, and now they're being monitored by planes and people are keeping a close eye on those.
And when did they actually start getting stranded on the beach?
Well, word quickly spread around 7-8 o'clock this morning that there was a few whales starting to strand up, and it became more and more. There was initially another pod that was offshore and they came in too. So at most, as I said, 160 whales were all down here from very early in the morning. But it didn't actually take volunteers and members of the Department of Biodiversity, Conservation and Attractions too long to get those whales that have survived back back out to shore. But it's been a massive day. There's been lots of people here. Lots of people brought their families along to help, to have a look. And it was quite distressing really early on to see these whales in pain and to see the 30 or so whales that have unfortunately not made it.
And Jackie, even the experts seem to say they can never tell why whales strand on the beach. Have any theories been raised today, or it still remains a mystery?
Well, it's always been a mystery why whales do strand up on the beach like this. And like I said, it's not the first time that this has happened. But every time that whales strand on the beach, we're learning more and more about their behaviour, about the animals themselves. And hopefully this can all help in to determine why whales do what they do. There is a little bit of talk that perhaps one of the whales was sick, and when they're sick, they tend to strand. And once one whale strands, unfortunately, the rest of the pod, the rest of the family, they end up stranding as well. And usually if you can manage to usher them out to sea, they kind of turn around and come back in. So it's a really positive sign to see them being taken out to sea and staying there.
And so what's going to happen now?
Well, these whales that are still out to sea, they'll be closely monitored over the next couple of days. Helicopters, planes out there, boats out there, all just keeping an eye on them to make sure that they're well offshore, and also keeping an eye on the beaches and the coastline as well. As for the whales that are still on the beach, the ones that have died, about 30 whales, there's some data and some samples taken from them, and then they'll be taken away for research. So they're bringing in the trucks to take those whales off the beach.
The ABC's Jackie Lynch at Toby Inlet in southern WA. As New South Wales police continue to investigate the murder of young mother Molly Ticehurst, experts are warning the system that's supposed to protect women at risk is riddled with problems. A review of laws and domestic violence protection measures is underway in that state after a court heard Ms. Ticehurst's former partner was on bail for charges including rape when he allegedly killed her. Some lawyers think the threat of domestic violence is poorly understood in their profession. Support groups agree and are trying to change that. Stephanie Smale has more.
Police allege 28-year-old Molly Ticehurst was killed by her former partner in Forbes just 2 weeks after he was released on bail. Victim support groups say a review of bail laws is worthwhile, but argue that's also just one part of a big and complex problem.
Two people going through the same system don't experience the same problems at the same point.
Kate Smith is the founding director of the domestic violence support charity Broken to Brilliant. She's a domestic violence survivor herself and explains different women are facing different problems with the legal system.
We have got people going through the same legal system, and at different points it is failing. You know, sometimes it fails with the police, sometimes it's failing with bail, sometimes it's failing in the courts with the lawyers and the judges, and so it's very hard to go, this is the point where we can fix it.
Kate Smith's charity has set up an education system for women to help them navigate the complicated legal system. They also run training sessions with police recruits where domestic violence survivors share what did and didn't help them.
We present some good cases and we present some bad cases where it hasn't gone so well. And we've educated over 700 police recruits, but it's going to take a long time. You know, we're just starting this little trickle of 700 recruits going out into the big Queensland police force.
Kate Smith says the majority of her charity's work is done by volunteers, and she's constantly applying for funding. And despite years of calls for better support, the CEO of Queensland's Women's Legal Service, Nadia Bromley, says services still don't have enough money to help all the women who need it.
The reality is we know just too many people are choosing violence instead of poverty at the moment.
Molly Ticehurst's death has prompted calls for more education for police, lawyers and judges about domestic and family violence. Nadia Bromley says the voices of domestic violence support workers should be given more weight during proceedings too.
We don't see compulsory subjects in law schools. We don't see compulsory continuing education modules around it in the same way that we do for things like legal ethics. So I think there's absolutely a huge opportunity to better inform our professional services so they can provide better, more trauma-informed services to women and other people when they need help.
From what you've seen in the court system, are domestic violence support workers given enough consideration? Are they heard in the court system?
Unfortunately, we know our frontline services are really under demand. So the ability for workers to actually even spend the time to come into court for every matter just isn't there. The reality is, unfortunately, when they do have that capacity, it might be that they're not being given the same level of attention or respect as other professions, which is disappointing because we know that people experiencing violence are the experts in their experience. But we also know that frontline workers are best positioned to understand and assess risk and help women.
The Domestic, Family and Sexual Violence Commissioner has called a national roundtable for authorities and services in the sector next month to talk about other moves that are needed. Nadia Bromley says it's time for action.
I think all of the commitments, all of the words that can be spoken have been spoken. I think it's about just getting on with how do we actually do this thing and prove to our community that we're doing it.
Initial findings from the New South Wales Bail Laws Review are expected by the end of next month.
Stephanie Smale. In the United States, pro-Palestinian protests are intensifying on university campuses across the country. Demonstrators have been arrested at the University of Southern California, while in Texas, hundreds of police officers have clashed with the protesters. This report from Rima Cheer.
Hundreds of Jewish students are breaking bread and hosting a Passover Seder at Columbia University. It's known as the Feast of Liberty, in remembrance of how the Jewish people escaped slavery in Egypt thousands of years ago. Jewish students at Columbia held these Shabbat prayers in solidarity with the pro-Palestinian protesters camped on the campus lawns. Sarah is a Jewish student who's been arrested in the past week.
My college administration, my representatives in Congress, and my own president have continually acted as spokespeople for the Jewish community, equating anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism, so that they can say that we're a fringe group or that we're not real Jews.
Other Jewish student groups and some politicians say that pro-Palestinian demonstrations in universities are stoking anti-Semitism and that Jewish students fear for their safety. But this Jewish student, Sof Ashkenazi, disagrees.
They reveal their ignorance of the reality of Jewish life by portraying the Jewish people as a monolith and erasing the stories of the thousands of us fighting for a free Palestine.
Tensions are simmering. These student protests are an example of just how divisive American support for Israel's war in Gaza has become among young people. At the University of Southern California, or USC, in Los Angeles, police arrested dozens of protesters with the school closing its main campus. This USC alumnus who supports the protests says the objectives are clear.
We want the university to disclose its financial holdings and divest from its relationships with financial institutions. And we want the university to recognize it has taken the lives of 34,000 people. It is continuing to this day and starving 1 million more people.
At the University of Texas, demonstrators were met with heavy police presence. Hundreds of officers filled the lawns, some were on horseback, and many were holding batons. White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre says President Biden is aware of the tensions at play.
The president believes that free speech, debate and non-discrimination on college campuses are important. They're important American values. And that and so he'll always be very clear. We will always be very clear about that here. Students should feel safe. Communities should feel safe. Obviously, it is a deeply painful moment. He sees that. He understands that.
But some politicians, like Republican House Speaker Mike Johnson, argue the protests are not free speech.
My message to the students inside the encampment is go back to class and stop the nonsense. If this is not contained quickly, and if these threats and intimidation are not stopped, there is an appropriate time for the National Guard. We have to bring order to these campuses. We cannot allow this to happen around the country.
Columbia graduate student Izepa Macias believes the protests are overshadowing why this movement began.
I think that the amount of media coverage that this is getting is actually taking away from what is happening over in Gaza and the war. while I am incredibly impressed and inspired and in support of what the protesting students are doing, I also feel like total and complete divestment is not going to happen.
Students are also protesting in Australia. They've set up tents as they demonstrate at the University of Sydney and the University of Melbourne.
Rima Chir reporting. Russia's aerial bombardment of Ukraine is continuing. The latest strike has hit critical infrastructure in the central Kherson region and injured several people. The American president, Joe Biden, has promised more than $60 billion of aid will soon arrive in the country. It's part of an enormous package the US Congress has finally approved to assist not only Ukraine, but Israel, Taiwan and other allies. David Taylor has more.
On this vote, the yeas are 79, the nays are 18. The motion to concur in the House amendment to the Senate amendment to H.R. 815 is agreed to.
The Senate sends a unified message to the entire world. America will always defend democracy in its hour of need.
Senate Democratic Leader Chuck Schumer.
We tell our allies, we will stand with you. We tell our adversaries, don't mess with us. We tell the world we will do everything to defend democracy and our way of life.
Rather than directly engaging its enemies, the US is supporting its allies as they engage in war. US President Joe Biden.
I just signed into law the national security package that was passed by the House of Representatives this weekend and by the Senate yesterday. It's going to make America safer. It's going to make the world safer. And it continues America's leadership in the world, and everyone knows it.
Despite being saddled with its own enormous debt load, the US has passed a $95 billion foreign aid package to assist its allies fight in war. $60 billion will head to Ukraine, $26 billion to Israel, and $8 billion for Taiwan and other Indo-Pacific allies.
It gives vital support to America's partners so they can defend themselves against threats to their sovereignty and to the lives and freedom of their citizens. And it's an investment in our own security. Because when our allies are stronger, and I want to make this point again and again, when our allies are stronger, we are stronger.
The package prioritizes boosting Ukraine's military might. Biden has immediately approved sending Ukraine $1 billion in military assistance. The package includes air defense capabilities, artillery rounds, armored vehicles, and other weapons to shore up Ukrainian forces. Joe Biden says Ukraine cannot concede any more ground to Russia.
If Putin attacks a NATO ally like he's attacking Ukraine today, we'd have no choice but to come to their aid, just like our NATO allies came to our aid after the September 11th attacks here. That's why we're supporting and surging support now to Ukraine, to stop Putin from drawing the United States into a war in Europe and in the future.
But this bill has taken, by the president's own admission, too long to pass. And even with a burst of new weapons and ammunition, it's unlikely Ukraine will immediately recover after months of setbacks.
America stands with our friends. We stand up against dictators. We bow to no one, certainly not Vladimir Putin.
The bill also includes about $26 billion in aid for Israel, of which $1 billion has been earmarked for humanitarian relief for Palestinians in Gaza as the Israel-Hamas war continues. Joe Biden says Israel must ensure the humanitarian aid for Palestinians reaches the Hamas-controlled territory without delay.
And everything we do is guided by the ultimate goal of bringing these hostages home, securing a ceasefire, and setting the conditions for an enduring peace.
Joe Biden sold this war aid package as a message to the world about the power of American leadership. That message was rammed home with an admission from officials that the US had secretly supplied Ukraine in March with a long-range Army tactical missile system with a maximum range of 186 miles, capable of reaching Russian territory outside Ukraine. The question now is whether the financial and military aid will be enough to ensure the United States itself is not formally drawn into any of the conflicts.
David Taylor. Thanks for joining me for PM this Anzac Day. I'm Samantha Donovan. You'll find all our interviews and reports on the PM webpage, and you can catch the program live or later on the ABC Listen app. That's where you'll find ABC News Daily with Sam Hawley each weekday morning. Tomorrow, ABC journalist Louise Milligan joins the podcast to discuss the problem of violence against women in Australia. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow. Good night.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Since the Bondi attack, and with the death of yet another young woman, allegedly at the hands of a former partner this week, discussion about violence against women in Australia has been reignited. Today, Louise Milligan on the National Conversation, her own encounters with threats of violence, and why men need to step up. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.